pornography, romance addiction, and forgiveness. The ninth talk in a series titled Sodom and Sexual Purity was presented by Jack Crabtree on March 4, 2003, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Yeah, if you weren't here last week, we realized that we had made a mistake in the schedule and had scheduled our last talk during the finals week for the Gutenberg student. So we decided to try to collapse this evening's topic and the last topic together into one evening. And that's what we had planned on doing, but something came up for Nancy and she couldn't make it. I'm not prepared to talk on her issue, but I'll give you a little bit of some ad lib comments on forgiveness tonight. But first, pornography and what I call romance addiction. We've talked before a little bit about the fact that male and female sexuality are different. I think that there's a significant difference in the way male and female look at sexuality and think about sexuality and experience sexuality. In fact, it seems to me where you can really see that that's true is when you get it to the perversions of our sexuality. That the perversion of male sexuality looks very, very different than the perversion of female sexuality. I think we see that in homosexuality, that lesbianism is a very, very different phenomenon, it seems to me, than male homosexuality. And we also see that in the topic tonight. It seems to me that pornography, as we typically think of pornography, is largely a male phenomenon and a male perversion. I'll just add here, and maybe I'll say more about it later, that seems to be changing in our society, in our culture, significantly. And I'm not exactly sure I can analyze what the implications of that are, but up until very, very recently, pornography is largely a male phenomenon. And the counterpart, it seems to me, among females, is an addiction to romance. And that's what I'm calling a romance addiction. I don't know how to define the difference between male and female sexuality. There are just some very, very broad comments that a person could make. But roughly speaking, male sexuality, it seems to me, is more focused on the strictly physical aspects of sexual interaction. Female sexuality tends to be unable to separate the physical aspects of sexuality from relationships. I say unable to separate them. That's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. But women often don't understand men because they don't understand how much the male psyche is able to turn sexuality into merely a physical act, into merely a physical thing. And I think in relationships, it's often very, very confusing to women, and women get taken advantage of to a great degree by men because they don't understand that the man does not love them. It's largely unthinkable to the woman that a man could just be using her sexually, that sex is love and love is sex. Well, not necessarily so for men. Men can have separated them in a way that is almost unthinkable to women. I've counseled with more than one woman who is just completely confused by that. And, you know, don't respond to what a man tells you. Respond to the way a man acts. Do they act committed? Do they act respectful? Do they act like they're ready to commit their lives to you? If not, they're not. Never mind that they're saying, I love you. That doesn't mean anything if it's not actually backed up by their actions. A very clever man realizes that words can be a kind of, not sure what word to use here, this isn't exactly right, but, well, words can be used to seduce a woman. And a very clever man learns that and uses language as a come-on. It may not have any content to it. It may not have any substance to the words. They just know how to play the emotional life of a woman. So female sexuality is more focused on the relational aspects of sexual interaction, more so, I think, than male sexuality is automatically and necessarily. Male sexuality tends to be more visual, probably, and female sexuality tends to be more emotional and correspondingly verbal. Now, in order to understand the relationship between the two perversions, however, pornography on the one hand and addiction to romance on the other, the thing it seems to me that both these perversions have in common is a willingness to go into the fantasy. And it's fantasy itself that's the fundamental evil of both of these. Now, there's a difference between fantasy as a literary genre. In a literary genre, like, well, any fantasy literature, is a genre that we create in order for people to observe. This is this world, this is this reality this fantastic reality that we create, that we can observe, and it can be interesting, and it can be entertaining, and it can be very, very instructive. There's a lot of useful messages that you can send in the literary genre of fantasy. But the difference between a fantasy, like Tolkien's Ring Trilogy, for example, the difference between that and what you have in sexual fantasy is that you don't have a dwelling in the fantasy. You know, when I read Tolkien, as much as I like it and as much as I enjoy it, I don't dwell in the fantasy. That doesn't become reality for me for a while. That doesn't become my world. I'm an observer of it. But there's something very, very different about the sexual fantasy that is going on in pornography and the romantic fantasy that is going on in what I'm calling romance addiction. There's a sense in which we make a choice to actually dwell in the fantasy and to be in the fantasy. I don't have a better way of describing it than that. Daydreaming can be like that, where it's not sexual. There's just other places that we go, another fantasy world that we create. But daydreaming can be more like something where I'm actually dwelling in the fantasy rather than observing a fantasy. Pornography, I would argue, is anything that is intended to encourage sexual fantasizing, that promotes sexual arousal in order to bring a kind of sexual high. Romantic fantasies, which are mostly a female phenomenon, anything that is intended to encourage romantic fantasizing. What I primarily have in mind would be soap operas and that genre and romance novels, that kind of thing. But the essence of both of these phenomena are twofold. They share two things in common, I think. They both promote this kind of fantasizing where you dwell in the fantasy, and they are both drug-like to a certain extent. That's clearer to me with pornography than it is with the other, partly because I can't relate to it as directly. But as you watch people who are affected by them, both of them seem to have the marks of being drug-like in their character. They are sensual, like drugs are, although I'm defining sensual broadly enough to include the kind of inner pleasures of the psyche, emotional pleasures as well as physical pleasures. So they produce a kind of high, and they are addictive. What about the ethics of pornography? It seems to me that pornography is not adultery. I've seen women whose husbands are struggling with adultery who have a hard time with it because it seems to them like this adulterous. But I think, again, that comes back to the difference between male sexuality and female sexuality. It's hard for the woman to see it as not another relationship, a competing relationship for the allegiance of her husband. The fact of the matter is, there is no woman on the other end of pornography, it seems to me. That's not how men experience that. There may be another body there, but there's not another woman there. So it's no more like adultery, certainly at least it's no more like adultery than romantic fantasizing among women is like adultery. I mean, there's enough distance there that that's not really the evil of what's happening there. The two evils of pornography and romance addiction, it seems to me, is this very act of dwelling in the fantasy. You know, no matter what the fantasy would be, to escape this world, to prefer another world, another reality, to be there, live there, enjoy that, and create my own world and reality instead of the one that God gave me, is an inherently wrong and rebellious thing to do. So that's the first mark against it. That's the first aspect of evil that I think you see in both of these things, the exchanging of reality for fantasy. And then the second one is just the evil of sensuality itself. Sensuality is an evil in New Testament ethics. What I mean by sensuality is not the fact that sensual pleasure is being experienced as sensual pleasure. That's fine. We're made for that. That's to be a part of human experience. But any time I give priority to sensual pleasure over moral rightness and moral goodness, then I have stepped over, I've stepped over a boundary where it becomes what I'm calling sensuality rather than simply sensual experience. I've never been able to find it, so I'm probably making this up, but it's such a good example that I'll use it anyway. In C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy, the second one, Out of the Silent Planet, Paralandra, there are these floating islands and there's these trees that grow on these islands where this Adam-like figure and this Eve-like figure are on this world and this unfallen world. There are these trees that grow up that grow these bubble fruit, these fruits that are like bubbles. And when the bubbles burst, a mist comes down over you or something comes down over you and you get this sort of feeling of ecstasy temporarily by this thing. And the Satan-like figure, this sophisticated man from Earth who's on the scene, is talking with the woman and here's where I can't find it and maybe I'm making all this up, but I probably extrapolated from what's actually in the book, but I think he's exploring with the woman, I've got an idea for you. Why don't you store up these bubble fruits and keep them in your possession, and whenever you want to have this ecstatic experience, you can just break one over your head. And the woman's response, I think C.S. Lewis, either he or I, had a very profound insight here. Her response is, why would I want to do that? I mean, this woman in her sinlessness, in her innocence, why would I want to do that? The idea being, this is a gift from God, whatever God was called in the book. This is a gift from God. It comes to me serendipitously. It comes to me when I'm not looking for it. It comes to me when I'm not expecting it. And I experience it as this wonderful gift from God. It would kind of spoil it if I took it under my control. There's something incredibly profound about that. That it seems clear to me, it seems obvious to me, the more I look at life and human experience, that God's intention for sensual pleasure of all kinds, and sexual pleasure in particular, God's intention for that was for it to be a gift from God, and to a certain extent, more or less serendipitous. And what I mean by that is, it just sort of comes to you unexpectedly. It wasn't the kind of thing that we were to make the staple of our lives and the staple of our existence so that we could have it whenever we wanted it, and that we could maximize it and we could have as much of it as we could. And in fact, it's not the kind of thing that I should necessarily have as much as you have not even really the kind of thing that I should compare. Am I having as much pleasure in life as other people are having? That if I can have a truly righteous perspective on this, the fact that I have any pleasure in this life is a gift from God, and I don't need any of it. It's not what life consists of. It's not what life is all about. It's not really the point of my existence, and it's not really even anything that gives substance and reality and fullness to my existence. It's the cherry on top. It's not the main substance of God's gift. Sensuality is denying that, is rejecting that, is rebelling against that. Sensuality is saying, no, I need sensual pleasure, and I will not and cannot live without it. And it is such a priority to me that I will go after sensual pleasure even if it means crossing the boundaries of what's right and what's good and what's appropriate and what's loving and what's caring and true. So in both the cases of pornography and romance addiction, I think both of those evils are present. Exchanging reality for fantasy and dwelling in the fantasy and giving priority to sensual pleasure. Okay, we can talk a little bit about the effects of pornography. It seems to me that the most significant and ubiquitous effect of pornography would be to create a kind of discontent with the sexual aspects of my marriage, if I'm married, and my marriage eventually, if I'm not married. Reality can almost never measure up to fantasy. The crucial thing, I think, in understanding pornography and its effects is how much of a head game sexual intimacy is. Most of sexual intimacy happens in the head, not with the body. It's a very, very psychological thing. But that has good aspects to it, but it also has a bad aspect to it. That's what makes pornography possible. Because it's such a head trip, I don't really even need another body. I don't even really need a physical material reality to sexually fantasize. Sexual fantasy is something I can do purely in my imagination, in my head. And the problem, of course, is reality can almost never measure up to that. I can always imagine better than it can ever actually be. If I feed on sexual fantasy, I end up losing touch with sexual realities. And I can put myself in a position where I am discontent with the reality because what I want is the world of my fantasy. Related to that then, that it can raise false expectations within the sexual aspects of my marriage that can't be met by the reality of my sexual relationship with my wife. It takes two to have a real sexual relationship, and it's the desires and interests and priorities and experiences of both that need to be taken into account. Not so in fantasy. In fantasy, I can make my sexual partner want whatever I want them to want and be pleased by whatever I want them to be pleased by and so on. But not so in reality. And so when I give myself over to pornography, I will raise false expectations about what can be and I should expect to be the experience in the real live sexual relationship with a real person. That then, of course, fosters a basis, not necessarily inevitability, but a basis for self-pity. And that in turn can lead to incredible depression. Self-pity is the worst kind of depression that we ever experience. This is sort of on an aside, but just to talk about self-pity just a second. My worst battle with self-pity was when years ago, my oldest child died when he was 2 years old. He choked to death. And I had two kinds of experience in dealing with my son's death. One was mourning and grief, which felt good. I mean, it really felt good to cry out the grief and the bitterness and the disappointment and the sorrow, to just be able to purge myself of that. Grief was purgatory. There's another experience that I experienced at times, sometimes in connection with my son's death, but I've experienced it in other connections as well, where it was fueled by self-pity. And self-pity, I think, is this decision that we make to punish ourselves psychologically and emotionally, to really make ourselves feel really, really, really bad because we want to be miserable so that other people can see how miserable we are, because we ought to be miserable because look what happened to me. Look how much I've been victimized by life, God, reality, other people, whatever. And I don't want to be, because they victimized me, I want it to be obvious that they victimized me, which means I need to feel really bad. And we inflict ourselves with this. The problem is, because self-pity is self-generated and is self-inflicted, there is no way out of it. There's absolutely no way out of it. It is this like bottomless pit that we get into, that we never hit bottom. We can never find the bottom to it. We can never resolve it. We can never rationalize our way out of it or counsel our way out of it or anything, because it's not about understanding. It's not about enlightenment. It's not about having a better perspective on things. I'm doing this to myself deliberately. And the only way out of it is to finally say, enough of that, cut it out, and just stop, which is what I had to do and finally learned how to do. If I become discontent with the sexual relationships, the actual reality of the sexual relationship in my marriage, often a common response is to begin to feel sorry for myself. I'm a victim. I'm not getting what I could get. I'm not having the kind of relationship I could have. Compared to what? Compared to my imagination. Compared to this fantasy that I've created for myself. The other problem, or the other effect, it seems to me, is that pornography increases an openness to things like fornication, adultery, because it reduces our moral scruples. And I'm not sure I understand the mechanism of that really, but it just sort of seems intuitively obvious to me, and it seems to be what I've observed in people. It creates a shift to an undue emphasis on the importance of physical sexual gratification to such an extent that I'm able and willing to cross moral boundaries that I wouldn't have otherwise. And then finally, it seems to foster an ignorance and an illusion about the realities of human sexuality, leading to a propensity toward unnatural, perverse, kinky sexual appetite on the one hand, and then also, very importantly in our society, a propensity to integrate violence with sex. And so it creates a propensity toward rape and the sexual abuse of children that wouldn't otherwise be there if I hadn't warped my appetite through pornography. Similar effects, not all of those obviously, but some of the same effects are there for being addicted to romance, a discontent with the relational aspects of one's marriage. Again, reality can almost never measure up to fantasy when it comes to, you know, in a fantasy world where a man is in love with a woman, that man makes her a goddess, and she is just the everything to him. No real man in the world can ever pull that off, can ever actually offer that kind of love, that kind of emotion, that kind of romantic focus and intensity as one can in one's fantasy world. And so that creates false expectations within the romantic and relational aspects of the marriage that can't be met, and again can lead to self-pity. It fosters an ignorance and delusion about the realities of the man-woman relationship, which can lead to a propensity to be out of control in one's romantic appetite. And that leads to a propensity to compromise sexually in order to gain romantically. So it leads to a kind of promiscuity, making a woman an easy woman. I've seen on numerous occasions women who are just captivated by the idea of romance, not even being interested in sex, but becoming promiscuous women because they're looking for romance and they think they can buy the romance with the sex. Okay, that's all I had planned on saying because I thought I only had half the time. So let me ad lib a little bit here about forgiveness, which was going to be Nancy's topic. There are a few things that I think are important to come to terms with. Probably the most important thing to realize is that virginity is a state of one's soul, a state of one's mind and one's soul, not a state of one's body. the best passage I've ever read, maybe not the best passage, but a very moving and a very interesting and a very tender passage on that topic is in Augustine's City of God. Augustine is addressing the problem of there were all these Christian women that when the barbarians came in and invaded the Roman Empire, raping and pillaging, many of these Christian women were raped by the marauding hordes of the barbarians. And Augustine is writing in response to their concern, because in their minds, they are no longer chaste women. They have been defiled, and presumably defiled before God, in God's eyes. And Augustine makes exactly the point that I just expressed, that, except he puts it, I think, chastity is a state of the soul, a condition of the soul, not a condition of the body. If you ever get a chance to read it, it's a very, very poignant, tender passage, I think, and very, very compelling, very interesting. You know, I can decide now to leave behind all of my past, all of the choices that I've made, all that's occurred, all that's happened to me, all the different people that my body may have been with. I can leave that all behind and simply decide right now to be chaste. And in making that decision to be chaste, I become chaste. It doesn't really make any difference what has happened in the past. Now, I don't want to make this sound too easy. I mean, obviously, I have to overcome momentum that I may have created in my own will and in my own soul by the choices I've made in the past. I have to resist those. I have to overcome those. I have to choose against those. But it's not a matter of, in God's eyes, I am somehow defiled now and irredeemably defiled. That's just simply not the case. A second point I think that needs to be made is that sexual sin is really no different in the sin department than any other sin that we commit. It seems like it's different to us. And I'm not sure I've analyzed all the reasons why it seems like it's different to us, but it seems like it's different because sexuality is such a deep and profound part of my being that to have misused my sexuality seems different than being a cheater or a liar or an embezzler or whatever. I think part of it is sexual sin feels like I get defiled by it. Cheating and embezzling just feels like I'm being dishonest. But sexual sin tends to feel like it's defiling. I expect that part of what's behind this, and this may not be all of what's behind it, part of it may just be cultural, but part of what's behind it, I think, is our sexuality is something that really does tie us to our physical, material, animal-like being. And we realize that if I simply give in to what our animal-like drives and impulses, that I have really, indeed, debased myself, dehumanized myself. What's the opposite? I've lowered myself to become more like an animal. And that's true. I mean, that is true. I have done that. That's one of the implications of my misusing my sexuality by simply living like a dog instead of like a human being. But even though that's the case, it's still just sin. It's still just a part of what we as human beings confront in every area of our lives. We are in rebellion against the truth. We are in rebellion against God. We are in rebellion against ourselves and our own created, our own makeup and so on. And that in and of itself, no matter how it manifests itself, no matter in what area of life it manifests itself, is reprehensible. It's what Jesus had to die for. But the fact of the matter is, Jesus did die as a propitiation to God, appealing to God for mercy on my behalf, and God is not surprised. We don't go to the judgment seat, and God is prepared to announce me forgiven and say, oh, you have some sexual sins in there? Oh, nobody told me that. You know, that's no surprise to God. To misuse our sexuality almost goes with the territory of what it means to be a human being, because sin is so ingrained in us. It comes naturally to us to be sexually perverse, natural to us as sinners. So what we need to do instead, what we need to decide, is to make a commitment to resist that propensity in me to abuse my sexuality and simply choose something better, something higher, something different. But having failed in the past is no obstacle to the forgiveness of God. I think I left something out on the other thing, but this will be... I left it out of my notes. What I wanted to say was, what's the antidote? How do I overcome an addiction to pornography, for example, or something? And I don't have any magic answers. I wish I did, but it seems to me it comes down to two things. I have to resolve in the bottom of my heart, I have to make a commitment from the depth of my being against sensuality and against fantasy. I mean, those are the evils that I am engaging in, and those are the things that I need to ultimately repudiate. And it seems to me that if I can get some perspective on those and get some understanding in that area, I can become fortified to be able to resist the draw of pornography or romance addiction or whatever. I need to decide, I need to be committed to be content with reality. Now that's a lot easier for me to articulate that than it is for you to do it or for me to do it. But that's what needs to be done. I mean, I just have to have a long, hard talk with myself, and I need to ask myself the question, am I content? Is it okay with me? Can I be satisfied that I am the creature that God made? I have the life that God has given me. I have the marriage that God has given me. I have the circumstances that God has given to me. This is my reality, and I'm content to live here and accept it and receive it and experience it as a gift from God? Or do I want to be my own creator and in my imagination create my own reality and live there? And that's the simple choice that we face. It's not simple to make the choice, but it's, I think, ultimately simple to understand the choice. And many people are going to make the choice, I'd much rather have the fantasy. I don't like this one. I'm not that interested in this one. God doesn't know what he's doing. But to do so is to choose darkness. To do so is to be foolish. Because ultimately we are created to be people in touch with the reality of our own life, the reality of God, the reality of his creation, and to live in that reality and be grateful, be thankful, and enjoy the reality that God has given. That's to choose light over darkness, I think. And then the same is true with sensuality. I need to choose to accept the pleasures of human experience as not the staple of my existence, but as just the serendipitous little bubble fruits that come along every now and then. Can I be content to live a life of integrity, of goodness, pursuing a life of character, of what the Bible calls holiness, whether I never have another pleasure again? And the decision I need to make again, it's foolish to decide, no, I need pleasure. We live in a culture, and this has been impressed upon me in just so many ways as I watch the TV shows and listen to the people on the radio and look at the movies and listen to the lyrics of the songs and so on. We have this message blaring at us all day long that you are somehow missing out if you don't have sex. Boy, are you missing out. And it's incredible to have to resist that message, but we do. I mean, that's the circumstances that we're in. That's not true. I am a completely fulfilled and substantive human being if I live a completely sexless life. If I'm living a life seeking to follow God and obey him and serve him, to love my neighbor, to love God, to do justice, to walk in mercy. those are the things that give a human existence substance. And sex is a wonderful gift that God has given, but nobody has to have it to be full. And yet, you wouldn't know that by listening to our society and our culture. You'd think that sex was the end-all and be-all of human existence. God created us in this world to have sex. And that's why we're here. Okay, sorry, that was pretty ad-lib, but maybe you can get more out of me with your questions or your comments. And since this is the last session, you know, questions on anything, as far as I'm concerned. Anything having to do with the topic of love, marriage, sexuality?
If a married person looks on another individual, aside from their spouse, with lustful intent, is that committing adultery in their heart?
Well, that's the language Jesus uses. But, so, that would sound like that's contradicting what I just said by saying it's not adultery. But I don't think that's what Jesus meant. I don't think what he meant is... So you remember the context where he said that. The context was, here's a class of people, the Pharisees, who are avoiding sleeping with their neighbor's wife. And they're going around patting themselves on the back for being God-fearing, God-loving, righteous men. Jesus' point is, okay, you may not be sleeping with your neighbor's wife, but you're lusting after her. It doesn't really make any difference that you don't sleep with her if your evil manifests itself in lust for her. So I don't think the point that he's making is lust is ethically wrong in exactly the same way that adultery is ethically wrong. I don't think that's the point that he's making. I think the point that he's making is you are violating the law either way. You have violated God's intent in the Mosaic command in the Mosaic covenant. So I think if you were to ask Jesus a different question and say, explain to me exactly why adultery is wrong and explain to me exactly why lust is wrong, I think he would give different answers. But that's not what he was doing in that passage, is analyzing the wrongness of those things.
So if they weren't standing around saying, look at how good I am, while they're still lusting after their neighbor's wife, he wouldn't say you're committing adultery.
Yeah, I guess so. He also wouldn't say that they're doing good either. I mean, he would still say that they're doing evil, but he may not have put it in quite that way if it hadn't been that they're not committing adultery was the very thing that they were priding themselves in. Yeah. So you're calling yourself blameless, Jesus says, for not being adulterers. I'm saying you're just as blameworthy as any adulterer. I think that's the spirit behind what he's saying. You're saying because you have not committed adultery, you're blameless. I'm saying you're blameworthy just like the worst adulterer. Or, if you want to consider it adultery, that's fine.
Well, no, I mean, I'm just having a hard time seeing how he would say that to them. And then... how he could say something different to someone who is doing the exact same thing, who's lusting after their neighbor's wife, but who acknowledges that what they're doing is wrong. I have a hard time seeing how he would call one of those instances adultery and one of them not.
That's what I'm saying, Jonah, is I don't think he's calling it adultery. Because I don't think the point is, they're not coming with the question, could you analyze the ethics of lust? Could you tell me, you know, do an ethical critique of and explain to me why lusting would be wrong? That's not the question on the table. The question on the table is, are you Pharisees good guys or bad guys? You all think you're good guys. I'm telling you, you're bad guys. You're just as unworthy as the most shameless adulterer. You're just as guilty as he is. And you yourselves would call him godless. Well, I'm telling you, you're just as godless as a shameless adulterer. I think that's the point that he's making. I don't think he's making an ethical point of comparing the two and arguing that they are the same sin or the same evil. You see it, I think, more clearly with the next one in that same passage. You've heard it said, don't commit murder. I say to you, if you call your brother Raca, fool, I think the idea being contempt, showing contempt for your brother, you have murdered him in your heart, or something like that. I don't think he's saying we ought to give the same ethical analysis of murder as we do hatred. They're not really morally equivalent, but they are spiritually equivalent, if you will, in the sense that
they're both symptoms
of my moral unworthiness, exactly.
In putting that together with a while back when you were talking about you were riding in a van and there were some people...
About the what?
You were riding in a van and there was people who were having this very sensual conversation.
Right.
Or whatever it was.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
And you had said that they, in their conversation, in a sense, had sex. I can't remember the words you used. But I guess, so is... If I'm getting this right, then it's all sin, and it's ugly, and it's certainly very ugly, and especially if a person is bragging about not committing adultery, but maybe they're being, if they're lusting, maybe, and maybe it's really a blatant situation. I mean, who knows, hypothetically. But, so it sounds like what you're saying then is that it's sin, and it's ugly, and it's no, you know, it's not... It's sin. Like, and you said a little bit earlier tonight, too, that it's all sin when you're describing if a person was a virgin or not, or if they, it's not just because sex is more of a sin. So is that what you mean? Does that make sense? So it's not that they were committing adultery. That's not what Jesus was saying. But, and it's not that, adultery, the consequences of adultery would be much more... Oh.
The personal social fallout from adultery is far more significant than a thought that I have in my head.
Yeah, it would be a lot harder to... But yeah, it would be more defiling. Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
so it's all
maybe
sin,
what's confusing,
but it's...
Maybe what's confusing you is that in the example that I gave about my hitchhiking trip, what I argued is that they were actually having sex before they actually had sex in the way that we think of it.
Right.
That their verbal come-ons back and forth was really having sex already.
Right.
I mean, that was a sort of a sexual foreplay.
Right.
That was the point I was making there. Well, that's not just lusting in your head. I mean, they're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, you know, flirting can be almost that
exactly.
way, too.
Exactly.
And who knows what those people were doing that Jesus was talking to, but it's all sin.
Right. And but I think the point that Jesus is making in the passage that Jonah brought up is not that they are engaging in sort of sexual behavior that they think is not full-blown adultery. They're not engaging in any sexual behavior. They just have desires in their heart that are not trumped by righteousness.
Right. Okay.
I mean, they're quite willing to entertain these desires. See these desires and not consider them a part of their evil, because if they would, they wouldn't be so caught and pick and self-righteous.
Mm-hmm.
They would recognize of themselves, God have mercy upon me. And that's what Jesus is calling their bluff, saying, no, you're not. Just examine your own heart and imagination, and you'll see what you're made of. You'll see what kind of person you are.
This is a completely off that subject, but it has to do with what our kind of what you touched on about media and the influences of what we see. And I, when you were talking tonight, it made me think of several men I've known that have a bar of either a physical appearance before they would even be involved in having a relationship of substance. Christian men, well,
as single people,
yeah,
you mean?
Yeah, as they're prowling, or single people on the prowl, looking for possible spouse mates or whatnot, and I watched that
spouse mate.
Yeah. Sorry. And so I almost look like at that as a form of materialism. It almost makes me. I mean, I have my own stuff too that I do that isn't right. But when I think of somebody making such a significant life decision as spending the rest of their life with somebody else, to have them 5 pounds overweight and it takes them off the list, or too average looking. I mean, I know what's going through there. I think a lot of it has to do with, Coors commercials. Or, you know, it's like, look at those ugly guys on the Coors commercials, and there's just women everywhere that are really attractive. And if, you know, I'll at least walk into a party like that someday. I don't know.
It is tragic. And for Christians to be thinking in those terms is unthinkable. What are they thinking?
Is that a romance or sexual thing that is along the lines of a material? It's a physical problem, isn't it? I mean, it's to do with the temporal, making your judgments about something substantial. Am I
right?
Okay.
Right.
Okay. I'm wondering if you can expound on the romantic addiction thing. Like, because every girl that I've ever met has grown up with this knight in shining armor, but we get to about, 15, and we realize that there aren't any guys out there that are knights in shining armor. So sorry, Jeremy, you're not a knight in shining armor. I love you. Is living in the fantasy still thinking that there is a knight in shining armor, or expecting a man to come really, really, really close to that?
Well, I think the more that's a less sophisticated, probably a more girlish version of what becomes more hip and sophisticated later. Women become cynical, and they realize that men have their problems and can't meet the image of the knight in shining armor. But it's not really, I don't think it's really ultimately about the men. It's really ultimately about yourself as a woman. That what you want is, you want to be loved, attractive, a magnet, an irresistible, and I don't mean physically necessarily, but as a person, irresistible to some man somewhere, so that he will want to devote his whole life to you because you are so amazing. I think it's probably more like that in the more sophisticated version. It's about being loved. It's about someone at a relational level giving up everything for me, allowing. It's harder for me to talk about that because I don't have a direct experience with it, I don't think.
Jack, would that be something like having ideas romantic ideas about how that person will care for you, and believing that they know that?
Right.
And when they don't, it's very disappointing. And then when you keep trying to tell them how they're supposed to do
right.
that, and they don't
right.
get... I mean, that's what I...
Yeah, exactly.
What you said, like... Anyways, thanks.
You know, for the longest time, Jody just thought I was incompetent. She just thought, if she just taught me how to do it, that would be... But it's not that we're incompetent, we're constitutionally incapable.
As I say, romance is pushed big time in the church, too. I mean, there's so many books out now on what a relationship ought to be, and how romantic it ought to be, and doing this and doing that right. And there's a certain point of cherishing one another and taking good care of one another, but the lie is that there's this perfect relationship out there that we should all have and attain to, and that it is possible.
Yeah. And I think I've talked about this a little bit before, but the female sexuality, even in its perversion, seems purer than the perversion of male sexuality. And I think that's where the church has gone, is that it's sort of decided we want to avoid perverse male sexuality, so let's embrace perverse female sexuality instead. And that's somehow purer. I think the truth is we need to reject them both. We need to be realists instead and learn what real relationships and real sexuality is all about.
Could you just maybe talk a little bit then on, if you're not looking for the type of girl that Ryan's friends are all looking for, and if you're not looking for someone who can read your mind, like,
That not looking for what you said?
Like if a girl's not looking for someone who can read her mind, like
reading her mind. So
yeah.
Okay.
Knowing how how she wants to be cared for or whatever. I don't know. I guess my question is like that's like knowing. Like how I think of as being caring is different maybe than what you would think of as being caring. So how do you tell the difference between those two? Do you understand my question?
I don't understand the last part. What you think about as being caring might be
like,
different in what sense? And what?
As a woman, think like a certain thing is caring, but maybe your caring looks different than that. How do I tell, how do I sort out between like, What is caring from your perspective?
Okay.
I guess that's my question.
Mine being a male perspective, or presumably?
Yeah.
Well, you not only have sexual differences, you have individual differences to deal with as well. So this can get very complicated. I think you just need to become a student enough of the person that you see through their actions, not their words. That's the really important thing. If I had any warning for you women, it's that don't listen to what we say, watch what we do. We men. And watch their behavior, their choices, their actions, and get to know the person inside through the choices and actions of the person.
And probably actually just thinking about it, that would be the actions to everyone, not just the actions to me. I mean...
Yes. Right. Are they compassionate? Are they arrogant? Are they just? Are they truth tellers, truth seekers? Are they merciful? I mean, by watching them in their lives, you can begin to answer some of those questions. You know, to what degree are they committed to this? Not that they won't fail, but then what are they doing with their failure? How do they look at their failure? How do they understand their own failure? You'll begin to see what seem to be the commitments of their hearts. You never know that for sure. That's why marriage is a risk. Because you never know for sure. Her face just went, damn. but you can get a pretty, you know, you can get a pretty substantive picture of someone if you've watched them over time. Yeah, and not just as they relate to you, but especially how they relate to other people when you can see them off guard, you know, where they're not calculating their actions to let you see what they want you to see, but where you're just seeing them in their spontaneity. And then as you get to see that, you get to know the commitments of their heart. And what you're looking for in another person for marriage is not somebody who's good looking and not even someone who's intelligent necessarily. What you're looking for someone is with a character, with a heart of gold, with commitments to the right things, and someone who understands what marriage is and is interested in that.
And you need to be careful with actions too, because we often interpret it through our own grid as this
right.
is what's good.
Yeah.
And somebody may be doing right and good, and you just, it's not what you're expecting or think is right and good.
Yeah. Especially, and that's the problem with infatuation. When you're reading somebody else's actions through the lenses of your own infatuation, everything they do is wonderful. I mean, I remember talking to a relative once who was, I'm in love with this woman. You should see the way she shifts from second to third. No. More remotely related than that.
Me again. Okay, you just mentioned that that you need to look at a person's character and not necessarily their intelligence. Where does a lot of the people around here are very intellectual, And where's the balance between this intellectual seeking for truth and character and intelligence? Like, how does that fit in there? Is seeking truth part of their character, or is that something that fits into intellectualism and intelligence?
Part of their character. Because there's so many different ways to seek truth. You can have, you know, you can imagine some very, very intellectually unsophisticated, very simple people farming the plains in Kansas? Whatever they're, prairies, whatever they're. That flat stuff in Kansas. Who've never read a single great book in their life, and have never gone to college, have maybe had a sixth grade education. But the way they've learned is just by watching people in life and watching God at work in their lives and in creation. And they just know a lot of stuff. They may not even be able to articulate to you very well what it is that they know, but by watching their lives, you know that they know it, because they always seem to choose the right thing. They choose the thing that's loving. They choose the thing that's true. They choose the thing that's just. They're humble. And those are not people who lack wisdom. Those are people who have wisdom. They may not be intellectually sophisticated in their ability to articulate their wisdom, but that's not the same thing. That's different. Some of us are more gifted than that than others, and it's an okay gift. It's a fine gift. There's nothing wrong with being articulate and bright. That's great. But it's no replacement for character. Marry somebody with character who's as dumb as a stick before you marry a really incredibly intelligent person who's a fool. The intellectual person may be more stimulating, but he's certainly not more faithful and trustworthy.
I guess I'm curious, like, what expectations is it okay to have of someone? We were talking about this some in girls' group, but like something, one of the things that came up was like safety. Like, my personal safety is very important to me, and that is an expectation that I have in someone that I would potentially marry, is that that would also be important to them. And I feel like it's okay for me to have that expectation. But when I guess what I'm hearing and what's making sense now is that maybe it's okay for me to want that, but it's not an expectation. It's not something that I can expect that my husband, and maybe safety is a bad example, but would immediately come into the relationship with that same priority that I have for that. And so, but is it okay to expect that I can ask that of them? Like, can you, not that can you place it at the same place that I do, but can you respect that this is really important to me and make an effort in that way? I mean, is that a loving thing? It seems to me like I am willing to make sacrifices for what they want. And so it seems like it would be okay in reverse, but I realize that I have all these expectations like that, and I don't know if that's a good thing or a loving thing.
Well, I think it's okay to have those expectations. It's what am I going to, how am I going to handle the fact that they're going to be, to some extent or another, disappointed? My expectations are going to be disappointed. How I'm going to look at that and how I'm going to process that is the crucial thing. I mean, in a way, we can't help but have expectations, because we're not even aware of all of our expectations until they're disappointed, and then we realize, oops, that wasn't on my list. I'm having a little bit of trouble with your particular example of safety. Can you give me what?
Well, I mean, like,
we were talking.
Oh well, never mind.
Like, if Heather was walking home alone in the dark one night, and her husband knew that, but okay, he didn't offer to go and pick her up.
And he, his own attitude was, that's not a big deal, you're okay.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I see. See, that's the sort of thing, that's exactly the kind of stuff that happens in marriage, where there has to be a give and take on both sides. On the one hand, Okay, let me give an example from my own marriage. I am almost 100% oblivious to my environment. It's probably only 98%. If there are piles of books and clutter and everything around me, I just read. You know, I mean, I just focus right there, and none of that stuff really matters to me. My wife is exactly 180 degrees the opposite. That she is incredibly sensitive to her environment, and her whole emotional experience is dictated by her environment. The loving thing for me to have done would have been, and to, you know, to just completely and utterly take care of her sensibilities in that regard, and just clean up everything and pick up everything and order everything to her standards. It's not that I was unwilling to do that, but the reason I'm oblivious to my surroundings also makes me not notice when I have not done those things, if you see what I'm saying. I mean, it doesn't even register that there's something there to be put in order or set aside. It doesn't go across my radar screen. So I have never become very good at that. I've become a lot better than I would have been, because recognizing how important it is to her, I realize that it's a loving thing for me to do, to do everything I can to come up to her standards. But she has been sorely disappointed by that, because I have not been able to succeed. And to her credit, she has been very gracious and very kind and very understanding and very loving to come to recognize I can't do it to her standards. It's just not going to happen. And so she tolerates to some extent what she needs to tolerate, or simply takes the burden upon herself to the extent that she does that. So we've sort of met, maybe not in the middle, but somewhere in between her and me. And the same could be true on something like that. I mean, there could come a point where the compromise is going to be, I'm going to have to take risks that I didn't think were possible for me. By the grace of God, I will take more risks than I thought were possible, on the one hand. On the other hand, it's not at all, you if your husband is at all interested in doing marriage the way marriage ought to be, then that's something that he ought to pay attention to and come as far as he can come toward accommodating your fears and your concerns and your values.
Just thinking about your thoughts concerning sex being intended for marriage, and then thinking about two people coming together to a friendship and then maybe potentially to marriage, and wondering what your thoughts are on the role of physical attraction, if that has a place, or my own experience with sexuality, it seems that physical attraction does play some sort of, but I'm not sure how to think about that, really.
Yeah. Let me answer two things at the same time. Physical attraction, and then coming back to Valerie's question, what about, you know, intelligence and stuff like that? No matter what it is that I might value, it's not that those things are not going to be important to me. They are, and I just can't help it. And my perspective is they kind of come out in the wash. That is, there's really only one question in the end that I need to answer, and then all those other questions are answered with it. And that is, am I willing to commit my life for the rest of my life to that woman or to that man? And understanding that in making that decision, what I'm doing when I make that decision is, for the rest of my life, I am rendering, whenever I meet another, in my case, woman, whenever I meet another woman, how should I put it? Whether or not she would have been a better wife is utterly irrelevant to me. That I'm going to render that an utterly irrelevant fact, an utterly irrelevant question. And so it's a question I won't even allow myself to entertain for the rest of my life. That's the commitment that I'm making. And in making that commitment, what all is going into my decision, yes, I am willing to commit? Well, looks may have played a role in that. Intelligence may have played a role in that. Their hobbies and recreational preferences and stuff, our interests shared in common may have played a role in that. I don't even know what role they played in that. But it really doesn't matter. The point is, I'm willing to make this commitment to that woman or to that man. The only place that that would get, the only place that gets problematic is when something like their physical appearance or their level of intelligence or their level of education or their earning potential or something like that is so, I have blown that so out of proportion in my own perspective that I'm saying no, I wouldn't want to spend the rest of my life with that person to someone that I'm out of my mind to not. I mean, in all other respects, I want to, and I have just artificially allowed myself to say no to something that otherwise I would say yes to because I have this really weird obsession with this particular thing, their looks, their intelligence, their earning potential, or whatever it might be. And that's where, you know, if I'm saying no, I can't commit myself to that person, I should take a good hard look at my value system and see whether this is just natural, I mean, it's just a part of who I am and I can't help it, or whether I have a really warped perspective that's actually playing into this thing. If physical attraction is a big deal to me, that's a warped perspective. My wife and I knew a couple, she knew them better than I did. I knew of them and my wife actually knew them, where the woman was just an absolutely beautiful woman. But I don't care who the person is. When you see them every day and they become familiar and they become ordinary to you, they cease to be as beautiful to you. So I don't care how beautiful or good looking the guy, beautiful the woman is or good looking the guy is, they won't be in 5 years anyway. I mean, even if they haven't changed, they won't be. Just familiarity itself. Pardon?
6 months.
6 months, yeah. Yeah. So it's such an unimportant criteria. I mean, it just has so little to do with actual marriage. I don't know if I finished the story. I mean, they had nothing but marital conflict and marital trouble. Her beauty didn't make any difference.
That's all. I was just going to make a comment. If you think about the most beautiful women we see in the media and whatever, and how many of them have had a marriage that's lasted.
Absolutely. And beauty is such a weird one anyway. I mean, it's so culture-driven, and it really becomes a question, am I going to get someone beautiful by someone else's standards, or am I going to marry someone who's beautiful by my standards? That's an entirely different question, too.
You were talking about making a choice to turn away from sensuality and pursuing a fantasy. Mm-hmm. What's that choice like? Is it something that you can just make once for all, or is it something you have to continually make throughout your life?
I think you have to continually make it. It's a choice. I think it's a choice that I can make at an existential moment where I really decide once and for all, I want my life to be about that, not about that. Mm-hmm. But even at that, it's going to have to be ratified over and over again. But it's easier to ratify it if I have really resolved in my heart at a crucial point in time. I'm going to change. I'm going to, as I think that's what the Bible calls repentance. Mm-hmm. I'm really going to turn around and not go that way. I'm going to go this way. And that, I think, can be made in a moment in time, at a critical moment in time. But it's not like it is not a struggle after that. I need to ratify that choice.
Yeah, it seems like that change can take some time.
Quite
a bit of time.
No, I think that's right.
So your fantasy equals sin concept, this isn't really about sex. Well, it could be. That kind of intrigues me a lot. My mind's whipping through whole bunch of areas where I can just see all sorts of shades of gray. What I'm kind of hearing you say is that it has to do with when it gets to the point of escapism, when you're not embracing the reality that surrounds you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
considering, when I'm actually preferring the fantasy to reality.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's obviously movies that are pornographic that lead one to into that. The sex movies are obviously that way. You're talking about Tolkien's movies. What if one were to so relate to a character in a Tolkien movie to where they start fantasizing? Do you start getting into the area of sin there?
I think so. I think it was somebody here who was talking about going to the last Lord of the Rings movie. And in line, they got there really, really early. In line right next to her was this young woman in this robe covering up her face, who offered him some lembas bread. So you might have a problem.
Right. So, and then along the lines of, there are computer games that suck you into almost an altered state of consciousness to where you're just so focused you don't blink. There's role playing, they don't have, and it doesn't have anything to do with computers, where they adapt the persona of characters. That's kind of what I'm envisioning.
Yeah, I don't know that any of those things. Of course, now I don't know. I have done so little with computer games that I can't. I don't have any first-hand experience with that. Except way, 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 way back when they first came out, there was a Lode Runner. Lode Runner is that? Well, it was more sophisticated than Pong. Well, Pong is a good example. I mean, you can get absorbed in something like that, and it's not like I was identifying with the ball. But you can get absorbed in just what can you accomplish and what can you do, and you got focus and concentration. I don't think that's, if that's the kind of absorption that it is, I don't think that's a problem.
Well, there are games that border on the pornographic now.
Oh, okay.
And that you put yourself in the place of a hitman going around and killing people and trying your best to kill people.
Okay, well, the actual content of that, in my mind, is not necessarily problematic because I think I can distance myself from the content of it. But I think all of those things have the potential, just like this lady with the lembas bread. Mm-hmm. I think they have the potential of what I call it dwelling in the fantasy. And I think any time we dwell in the fantasy, that's a problem. So I wouldn't want to make a blanket judgment that video games are wrong or role-playing is wrong, but I think they could be. I think there's a danger there. Yeah.
Is that along the lines of a Sears catalog can be something to shop for underwear, or it can be a pornographic magazine for a man?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, then on the other end of the spectrum, do you ever think it's possible in the life of a believer to be so affixed on the things to come in eternity to where they lose grip of what's around them in the reality?
Yes, good point.
Same thing.
Yeah, I think it could be. Where we come, if it becomes a kind of an obsession, such that I forget that Christianity is also about about now. Yeah, good point.
It seems like there's a lot of things in life and our culture and stuff, when you say video games and stuff, and I think of music too, where they can be just kind of neutral in a lot of ways, but you can, I know I myself, I can see myself sometimes, it's like, or even the Lord of the Rings movie or something, where you could see yourself getting near the edge of, you could kind of see a cliff in the distance or something. Or if I went into this a little more, I mean, I could imagine that I could go too far, and you can feel a little, I don't know, seems like a little danger warning sign sometimes, that they're just, I don't know if that means, I don't know what that means, but just kind of seems like there's potential, like you're saying, in a lot of areas where we can just go into it too far. But sometimes that may not mean that we have to just distance ourselves totally from that, but sometimes it might too, or something.
Yeah, and I think that will differ from individual to individual. I cannot imagine myself dwelling in the fantasy of violence, because violence just has no attraction to me. But there are people that I've talked to who say, no, I can see that. I could see that happening to me. And I can't even relate to that. I mean, violence always repulses me. It's never interesting to me. It's never attractive to me. But I guess that there are men who the violence for its own sake is an alluring kind of thing. So I think it depends on the individual.
I can identify a little too closely with being obsessed with Tolkien.
With the what?
Being obsessed with the Tolkien movies. But I've actually been thinking about this a lot for myself, like wondering how much interest is healthy. Would you say that the problem with any kind of fantasy, like sexual, romantic, Tolkien, whatever, would you say that the basic problem is I am saying, no, I don't like my life. I want this one. So I'm just going to like exist here.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that the sin?
That's when we've crossed over the line. We may not articulate it in quite that way. I mean, it may not be conscious. That's not how we consciously present it to ourselves. But when it amounts to that, when I've really decided that the life that God has given me and created for me, I'm not interested. I don't want to live that life. And so I want to go somewhere else. And I'm going to take it in my own hands to create that other place that I'm going to go to. Then I think that's what a lot of psychosis is. I think a lot of insanity is where my imagination goes into overdrive and creates a whole different reality for me. And I'm not saying all these things are insane, but the root problem, underlying problem, is the same.
Is there a difference between escapism
and escape?
Escape. You want a break from...
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, you go see a movie because you've had a hard day, or
yeah.
you just want to veg out for a while.
Yeah, that's just, I want to rest from my task, my burden, my labor, my concentration.
And enjoy a good Tolkien book.
Yeah, I want to be entertained. Yeah. I don't think entertainment is a problem. But... I think there are people who consume so much entertainment that it's a problem. I mean, their whole life is given over to nothing but entertainment. Well, what about reality? You know, what about responsibility? What about what God has given us to do? What about our mission, our calling, and so on? Then entertainment becomes a problem. It's not just a break. It's my life. Okay? Well, thank you. That's been fun.